It's a pleasure to see an audience of this size. Thank you for coming. This is, I think, the eighth or ninth Western lecture, which is, in fact, Loblaws, if you want to know who the Western were, and they have supported the college for these 10 years. I want to say a few words about that, because it's a pity to miss the opportunity where so many of you gathered. About 11 years ago, a group of half a dozen professors from the University of Ottawa were brought together, I think, largely by providence and by the fact that we realized that the university is corrosive of faith. Many of you have had the experience of sending your young people to university and finding they came back bereft of faith. We thought about what was involved, and we decided that the problem was that professors today are highly intelligent but narrowly educated. And they often pontificate outside their areas of expertise. The problem is that students don't know when they do that. So we thought the solution to that was to teach them the history of ideas so that they would recognize when an unsubstantiated statement was made. Now, I don't know the figures for the Catholics, but for the Protestants, about 80% of students going to university with a faith will be at least, what should we say, underground Christians by the end of the experience. If they take our course, in which we teach the history of science, medicine and mathematics, art and architecture, literature and philosophy, the history of the church and the history of music, and Latin to make them a bit more logical, if they take that course, that figure goes to 90% coming out of university with a flourishing faith. And despite the fact that we have no official accreditation because we're not politically correct, last year the University of Chicago gave one of our graduates all the liberal arts credits she needed for pre-med because of what we had taught. We need your support, though. So when you leave, look at our materials, as well as the Polish materials and St. Timothy's. These are all attempts to really preserve a form of education that made the Western world what it is. And we are currently in danger of losing that because of a militant atheism, which is not based on any reality that can be substantially supported. It's really delightful for me that we should have someone like Dr. Heller to talk, because it's appropriate that a Polish person should be doing this talk. After all, the great transformation began with Copernicus, proceeded through Kepler, Galileo, and Newton. And then, amazingly, four guys who believed in God gave us a tacitly atheistic universe where someone like Laplace could say, I no longer need the hypothesis of God. Not actually true, and Dr. Heller is a living example of what can be achieved when you refuse to go in that direction.
The title of this talk, Did It Start With a Bang?, was suggested to me by the organizers of this meeting, but I think it's an excellent answer. This is just the just question. Did it start with the bank? And this title page of our talk today illustrates that. We are asking this important question. We address that to the universe, and the universe responds us, gives us an answer, provided we are equipped with a good instruments just to listen what the universe has to tell us. And I will guide you through the next 40 minutes or so through the enormous and exciting excursion. We will start from the pre-present epoch of the universe, and we will go back till we reach the very beginning of the universe. I want in this way to reconstruct what modern cosmology has done in the last few decades. I think that one of the most lasting achievements of the 20th century is the discovery of the history of the universe. I had a chance just to be a witness of these great discoveries in cosmology. When I started my scientific career in the 60s of the last century, cosmology was just a beginning, its great progress towards the future. And now it is one of the most important scientific achievements of our times. Here on this picture we have a kind of summary of what is called the standard model of the universe. It's a pity that I cannot tell you all the details how we have deciphered that history. I must be limited only to just tell you about the most important achievements. But I hope it will be also very exciting. So we start from that end of the picture. This green arrow indicates that now, during our talk, we are here. This is the modern universe, the today of the universe. And we know that the present epoch of the universe is old one. The age of the universe now is, on that picture you have 12 to 15 billion years, but now progress has been made and we know much better that real age of the universe is exactly 13.7 billion years with accuracy up to 3%. Which is enormous achievement. We know that owing to the scientific data, empirical data sent us by a satellite now in orbit. Now the universe is composed of galaxies. The main structure in the universe are galaxies. And so we say that we are now living in the galactic era. Here you have a couple of galaxies. These are enormous congregations of stars, and we ourselves also live in such a galaxy. Of course we cannot photograph a galaxy from outside, our galaxy, because we are inside, but our galaxy is similar to that one. Galaxies represent a lot of various shapes. You can see a spiral galaxy here, this beautiful one with a clearly visible center nucleus of that galaxy. This is another spiral galaxy. The photograph is made with a different filter. Astronomers use various filters in order to decipher various kinds of information out of the picture. All these pictures were taken by the Hubble telescope, which is now on orbit and sending us further photographs. Here you have another shape of a galaxy. These spiral arms are a bit different shape than here. And this is a very interesting picture because it shows us that in that galaxy, besides the shining matter, there is also some dark matter here which screens light from other parts of the galaxy. So you see the morphology of the universe, the richness of shapes of galaxies is enormous. So the universe is also a piece of art. It's something very beautiful. Here you have a galaxy, Whirlpool galaxy it's called, and our galaxy is similar to that one. Sun, which is our sun, which is one of many stars, is if let's imagine that it is our galaxy. This is a nucleus, the center of the galaxy. There are some outskirts of the galaxy, and our sun would be located somewhere here, two-thirds of that distance, in one-third to that side. So on that picture, our sun would be absolutely not visible, so it is a kind of humility for us that in the universe we, with all our problems, our wars, our politics, we are simply invisible, insignificant, just a little invisible dot of matter. And this picture is interesting because you see here such white patches. These are places in which new stars are born, because stars are born out of the ashes of former generations of stars. They explode, and from the ashes of these stars, other stars are born. So this is the panorama taken from the present state universe, the present cosmological era. We are back to the same diagram, but now we are moving a little bit further. Our green arrow moved from this to this, and we will be at the end of the galactic era, And if we go backwards in time, and in fact it was the beginning of the galactic era, let's notice that these two lines are receding from each other. This tells us that the universe is in fact expanding. At the beginning it was very small and dense, and then we have an expansion of the universe. So if we are going backward in time, then the galaxies are closer and closer. And at a certain moment, they touch each other, and this is the moment when the galaxies were born. And, can we see that event? Yes, we can, and this is something extraordinary. Here is a hero of that enterprise. It is the Hubble telescope, which made all these beautiful photographs and is still working on the orbit. Some other new telescopes are being prepared now to replace Hubble, but he's still a good one. And it's, of course, a dream of every astronomer to be given a time to observe by this telescope, to do research on his own program. But it's very expensive, so only very few good astronomers or good programs can achieve that. But the director of the program, when Hubble telescope was launched, had a privilege of 100 hours of observations on that telescope. And he invented a very simple program. Just direct the Hubble telescope on a single spot in the sky and make a photo exposure which would last 100 hours. And the result is this. This photo. The light which was emitted, which was emitted, say, by this proto-galaxy, reached us after 9 billion years of traveling. So this picture shows us the universe as it was used to be 9 billion years ago. Cosmology and astronomy are in a very privileged sense. They can look in the past. We can see the past with our own eyes. These fragments here on that picture, this one, bright one is a star in our galaxy, which is just superposed on that picture. But this here, there are fragments, proto-galaxies, which later on will be joined to form a galaxy. So this is perhaps the most remote thing we can see with our telescopes. But we would like to know what was before. Could we see that? Yes, we can. But we must use another tools. The gravity is a very powerful force in the universe, because all these shapes of galaxies are in fact created by gravity. And physical theory which deals with gravity is general theory of relativity, which is very important tool in the kind of theoretical cosmologies. But let's go back to that picture. Here is the beginning of the galactic era. And cosmologists, long ago, in 1948, there was a cosmologist of Russian provenience, but he was working in the United States, George Gamow. He and his team computed that the very young universe was filled not with the ordinary matter, but with radiation. And that part of the history of the universe from now toward that end is called radiative era. But at that time, in 1948, there were no technical possibilities to observe the remnants of this radiation field. Only in 1965, people were able to see what happened, what was behind this beginning of the galactic era. This picture explains you a little bit the problem, the main difficulty. Here we have a man who is just looking on the cloudy sky. And this part of the sky is transparent. It's blue, and we know that view from our own experience very well. But our eyes cannot penetrate here because we can only see the surface of the cloud where light is scattered here. And this is transparent and this is opaque. And something similar happens in astronomy. If we have an observer, a present observer here, and this part is a galactic era which we can observe, but at that time when galaxies began to form, there was a scattering of that radiation field and we cannot penetrate with the optic waves here. But happily enough, Gamow and his team and then other cosmologists computed that there should be remnants of that radiation which are present, should be present in our universe. But at that time, after the Second World War, there was no possibility to discover that radiation. But it was 1965. The era of satellites already was with us, and there was a very well-known American Bell telephone company who conducted, you know, transmission of information for long distances. And they realized that there are some noise which are perturbing this transmission on the long distances. And they hired these two people, Pensias and Wilson, two engineers, to investigate the source of that noise. These two gentlemen constructed this antenna, radio antenna, and made an observation, and they noticed that the source of that radiation is not connected with our planetary system. Then they discovered that the noise is not connected with our galaxy, so it's of cosmic origin. And they could not explain the origin of the reason, the source of that radiation. But at that time, there was another team working in Princeton in the U.S. who wanted to construct a special detector which would be able to register the cosmic radiation predicted by Gamow's team. And by chance, people from Princeton learned about the discovery of these two people, and they joined together. It turned out that the noise which perturbed this transmission of information for long distances is exactly what they were looking for. It's a remnant of the Big Bang, we can say. Now, in cosmology, it's called microwave background radiation. The microwave background radiation is filling entire universe. We can say that every point in the sky is emitting the same intensity of this radiation. So, and this radiation has exactly the same physical properties as they were predicted by Gamow and his fellows, companions. And this is a diagram which shows us some physical properties of that radiation which were predicted by Gamow. And nowadays, the cosmic background radiation is a powerful tool in cosmology owing to which we can reconstruct what happened in the very early universe. At the end of the 70s, a new satellite was launched. This satellite here, which was called COBE satellites. COBE is an abbreviation of Cosmic Background Explorer. And the main goal of that satellite was to make, I am of course simplifying things, a picture of the very early universe. And this picture is here. These red spots are a little bit hotter than the blue ones. The difference is very, very tiny indeed, but nevertheless it is very important because these hot patches are places which are a little bit denser than the other ones, and they are seeds of future galaxies and clusters of galaxies. So these pictures, we can say that this is a picture of the universe as it was 3 100,000 years after the Big Bang. So on the cosmic scale, it is just tomorrow after the Big Bang. Again, here we have some physical characteristic of this background radiation field, which I have no possibility to explain everything today. But I can say only that making a statistical analysis of this picture, cosmologists are able to tell you a lot about the early universe. Not only the distribution of matter, but also the composition of chemical elements, and many other very interesting things. So it was a great interest of cosmologists to learn more about background radiation field. And then they obtained, they reached their goal, and another satellite was sent to investigate this background radiation field. This is called WMAP satellite. MAP is an abbreviation after microwave probe, microwave anisotropy probe, and the W is after the name of Wilkinson, who was a very, very important researcher of that problem, but he died, and they wanted to honor him, and this is WMAP satellite. It is now in orbit for a couple of years already, and is continuing to send us a stream of very, very important information. And here we have a map, the same map as before, but this is made by WMAP satellite. For comparison, you have here the old map by Kobe, and you see that much, much more details is visible here. So the analysis of what happens here provides us with a new set of information. What we have learned from MAP, the main information which was obtained with the help of WMAP satellite is the following. Of course, there is much more detailed information, but it's just a kind of summary. First, we have learned that the universe is 13.7 billion years old, with a very great preciseness. This was rather expected, this age of the universe. The order of this figure was expected, but this is complete surprise. It turns out that in our universe, the ordinary matter of which we are composed, the matter we know from our everyday experience, is only 4% of the content of all content of the universe. The rest is something which we don't know about. We think that 23% is dark matter. It is similar to our matter, but it is invisible, it is not shining, but it is not composed of atoms we know. It's something different, and we do know exactly what is it. And 73 is called dark energy. This dark energy is rather only a name. This name just covers our ignorance. It's very often that if we do not know something, we just give a name. And then it's at least tamed in some way. Then we have learned that the space of our universe is flat. At least, two cosmologists would say, at least to the horizon. Within this domain we can control with our telescope, we cannot notice or spot any curvature of space. So up to the visible horizon, the space is flat. This does not mean that somewhere further on, beyond the horizon, the space could start to curve. And another surprise was that the first stars are very young, or from our perspective very, very old, because first stars were formed 200 million years after the Big Bang, which is much less than we supposed.
Okay, thank you.
Well, so this background radiation field 300,000 years after the Big Bang, but we want to know what happened before. And radiation cannot penetrate those regions. But happily enough, there are tiny particles, very difficult to be detected. If our sun is emitting great stream of neutrinos and they pass through Earth without any problem. So they are very difficult to detect. But now physicists start to register solar neutrinos. This is done in the following way. We construct a detector of neutrinos here, 2 kilometers under the ground. This is, in fact, in Canada, Sudbury Neutrino Observatory. It is in the old mine. This is the old mine. And here is this detector of neutrinos. The idea is that some neutrinos coming from the sun will be captured by these layers of rock, and some could be registered here. For the time being, we are able to register only some neutrinos coming from sun. But if one day our technology is improved and we will be able to detect neutrinos from the cosmos, then these neutrinos could bring us information from the very, very early stages of the cosmic evolution. And this is another neutrino detector in Japan. It's called Super Kamiokande. And this picture shows, this is also under the ground. You have here a big lake of water, a special chemical fluid. And the idea is that the neutrinos will be slowed down and we will capture here. They will react with atoms of this fluid and detect it. And here you see the constructors are happy because the first signal has been obtained. But so far, as I say, these neutrinos are coming from sun, from the sun. And, but we hope that one day we will improve our technology and then we will be able to collect the information from the very, very universe. But our curiosity is enormous, and we would like to know what happened before the neutrinos were emitted in the very early universe. There is one possibility: gravitational waves. I already mentioned general relativity, that it is theory of gravity. And if a stone falls down, it probes the curvature of space-time. In the vicinity of a mass, of a, say Earth or planet, space-time is curved, and other small bodies always move along the straightest lines in space-time. So if a stone falls down, it goes to the center of the Earth, along the shortest, the most straight path in space-time, which is curved. This is, well, symbolically showed on that picture here. So when we have a collision of two great masses, then this can cause a gravitational wave, and gravitational wave is just a system of curvatures of space-time. So you must a little bit exercise your imagination. You have space in which we live, we have time, which is shown by our clock, and gravity is a curvature of space and time. Space-time is space and time combined together. And here you have the collision of two galaxies. This is how we observe this collision from the surface of the Earth. And this is the same picture as photographed by the Hubble telescope. Two big galaxies are collided. And, of course, such a collision creates a powerful gravitational wave. But gravitational waves are even more difficult to be detected than than neutrinos. But nevertheless, nowadays we construct first gravitational wave detectors. This is one in Hamburg here. Another one is in Japan. Another one is in Canberra in Australia. And they work in team. If the gravitational wave will be passing through the Earth, all these three detectors should react simultaneously. But again, we hope to detect gravitational waves only from, let's say, nearby events like collision of two galaxies. For cosmologists, galaxies are nearby. But we are interested in the beginning of the universe. So again, we must wait till the technology is improved when we will be able to detect gravitational waves from the very Big Bang. Because Big Bang had to be a great motion of various of masses, of energy, and this evidently caused powerful gravitational waves, and they should be around this year, but the problem is how to detect them. For the time being, we have no technology of doing that, but we have another powerful tool, our mathematical models. Because everything which I am speaking about was first computed, where first mathematical models were constructed, and then astronomers looked at that place where theoreticians told them that they should look, and usually they found everything which was predicted. So mathematics is another step towards the beginning. Here, our familiar picture. We have here the era of when the last scattering surface from that point on, we have a radiative universe, background radiation. Here we have 1 second after the Big Bang. This is a very important moment. I have no possibility to speak about that, but the chemical composition of the universe was decided here. The fact that we exist strongly depends on what happened here, because we are made out of chemical elements, especially carbon, and here atomic nuclei were coming together to form various species of atoms. And here we have, well, perhaps neutrino cosmology will reach us to that place. This is a hypothetical event. After the Big Bang, the universe accelerated. The expansion of the universe accelerated. This is called inflation, cosmic inflation. And if we have a cosmic detector of gravitational waves, we would be able to reach this region here, which interests us the most. But now a little bit of theory. I said to you just a moment ago that gravity is a curvature of space-time. Look at that picture here. You have this line represents space-time in one dimension, just for simplicity. And if there is no matter in it, the space-time is flat. There is no gravitational field. But let's put here a little ball, this ball. And we can imagine this as a piece of rubber, for instance. And if we put a little ball on the rubber, then there will be a curvature here. It's curved. And if we put here another little ball, it will go down along the straightest lane to that one. It looks like this one is attracted by this great mass. This is the main idea of general theory of relativity. Mass creates gravitational field, and gravitational field is nothing else but curvature of space-time. Well, if so, then we can put a heavier, more massive ball here, and then the curvature will be bigger than here. And here is something which can see. It's again a picture of the Hubble telescope. This on that picture we can see the curvature of space-time. Namely, this great mass here curves the space around itself, and the light coming from galaxies which are situated behind this big mass, the light coming from the galaxies is curved here. You can see it acts like a lens. This is called, this effect is called gravitational lensing. And in fact, gravitational lensing shows us how space is curved around a big mass. So this is not only a theoretical imagination, but again, mathematical model is to some extent corroborated or verified by astronomical observations. Well, so let's make an experiment, a thought experiment, and let's put here even heavier mass, much heavier mass. What will happen? The rubber could break down. Space-time is not only curved, but can be broken down. And this is what we call in theoretical cosmology the singularity. And the Big Bang was exactly the singularity. So it is not a point out of which everything started, as it's usually presented in popular literature, but it is a place. Place is a bad word, but we have no better one, at which space-time ceases to exist. It's broken down. So place is a bad word because place presupposes space, and there was no space in the Big Bang. So this picture is taken from a scientific monograph written by one of these two gentlemen. Gentlemen, this is Steve Hawking, this is Roger Penrose, two eminent scientists who contributed a lot in discovering or in interpreting all these things concerning the singularities and Big Bang. You have here space-time, which is flat, but in the vicinity of a great mass is curved, and the mass was so great that the space-time here was broken down, and we do not know what is going on here. It's a big question mark. And if we think about the Big Bang, the very beginning of the universe, we should have in mind exactly that picture. Is this only a theory without any empirical corroboration? This is again Hubble telescope picture, and you can see, in quotes, see the singularity on that picture. This is a center of a galaxy with a catalog number, this one, Natural General Catalog 4261. This is a center of the galaxy. In the center of most of galaxies, there are black holes. Black holes are such places in which there are singularities. There are so much matter that space-time is curved and broken down. We cannot see that because the gravitational field in the black hole is such a strong field that nothing can go out of the black hole. If there is inside the black hole, there is a photon, the light, say, then this light is in the gravitational field reversed back to the singularity, and this is why it's called black hole. But if there is a lot of matter in the vicinity of the black hole, then this matter is being engulfed by the singularity, by the black hole. And this is called by astronomers accretion disk. The matter here is, well, going that way and is falling down into the singularity, and this matter, the velocities of this matter are very great, and the particles of that matter emit X and gamma rays and can be registered, and this picture has been registered. So we cannot see the singularity in the Big Bang, but we can see, at least from outside, many singularities which are in the insides of galaxies, and we have several pictures like that one. And here you see again the illustration showing you the curvature is so huge here, that curvature here and that here, the space-time is broken down, so we have a singularity. In fact, what does it mean that space-time is broken down? This means that our scientific model does not work any longer. To know what's going on there, we should have a better model, perhaps. For the time being, or perhaps forever, we do not know what's going on there. And now the question which cannot be avoided. Anytime I speak about that to a general public, this question comes out, even if I don't ask it. Is the initial singularity the act of creation? Many people believe that it is so. Even some cosmologists are persuaded that they have captured the hand of creating God. One of the astronomers, Jastrow, wrote a beautiful book in which he says, he writes that after many attempts and trials, after many gigantic efforts in cosmology, astronomy, mathematics, scientists finally have reached the very high peak, and they wanted to see what happens at the beginning of the universe. And we did that. They spotted at that place a gang of theologians which were sitting over there and laughing at them. So many people indeed believe that it is the act of creation, but such a belief, in my view, is a great theological simplification. First of all, from the theological point of view, creation is not only the initiation of the existence, like perhaps the initial singularity was the initiation of the present stage of cosmic evolution, but creation from the theological point of view is rather a continual justification of existence. You can imagine creation as a continuous giving by God the existence to the universe. So the creation is not only the beginning, but everything which followed later on. This is a traditional teaching even of church fathers and the entire medieval theology and also modern Christian theology. Because creation is in fact a relationship between the creature and the creator. And this relationship consists in the continual dependence on the Creator, which gives to everything which exists its existence. So the creation is just an answer to the very cute question asked by famous philosopher Leibniz, who asked, why does exist something rather than nothing? This is the real problem of creation. And identifying the initial singularity with the act of creation, I think it's not fully justified. Of course, we cannot forbid God to create the universe just in the singularity. It could happen, but we simply don't know. For the time being, the initial singularity is a point at which our knowledge breaks down. And God shouldn't be treated as a hypothesis with which we fill gaps in our knowledge. And theologians usually call such an idea, when we have troubles in the scientific image of the world and you fill it with God, they call that idea God of the gaps. And this is a compromise idea in theology. As I say, we cannot forbid God to create the universe in the initial singularity, but we simply do not know. And this is a bad theology to say that for sure it was just the beginning, it was creation of the universe. Can we hope some more insights into what happened in the initial singularity? Yes, we can, but for the time being we don't have such insights. Namely, nowadays in physics there are two greatest physical theories: general relativity, which describes the universe on the cosmic scale, and quantum cosmology, which it describes the universe in the microscale. Quantum mechanics, not quantum cosmology, quantum mechanics describes the universe in the smallest scale, on the scale of atoms, quarks, electrons, and so on. And near the beginning, when the universe was very dense and compact, then we are sure that these two theories should be one, should be unified. But the mathematical structure of general relativity and quantum mechanics is very different, and so far we have no theory which would unify these two theories. We have the name for such a theory. It's called quantum gravity theory. Quanta and gravity would be unified. And there are many works done nowadays just to find such a theory. I must say I'm working in that field as well. And there are many attempts to do that. Some of them are well known to the public. For instance, the superstring theory is one approach, but there are some other approaches as well. And when we have such a theory one day, then perhaps we will know whether the universe indeed began at that initial singularity, or perhaps it was something else before. And there are some very interesting suggestions that in the very initial singularity, these suggestions come from many, works which are done now, but which are not yet conclusive. And the suggestion says that the very near the beginning, in the so-called Planck era, there was no time and no space at all. And if there was no time, then the question what was before is meaningless, because without time we cannot say what was before. So this is indeed a gap in our knowledge, and we should not fill it with God. If so, where we should look for God? This is a very good question. And my answer is this. I like that you like it. But it is not only the problem of aesthetics. Sorry. It is not the problem of aesthetics. It is a problem of a very good philosophy of science. Let's look at this formula. I don't enforce upon you understanding them. Although the physicists are used to say that to understand mathematical formulae, in fact, it is not a difficult task. You must operate with them till you are accustomed to them. Because in physics, to understand means to be accustomed to. But one evening is perhaps too short to be accustomed to. Okay. This equation here, it's called Einstein field equation. And almost all information I was talking to tonight to you are encoded in that equation. So it was a very powerful equation. Einstein wrote that equation in 1915. And he was not aware about the existence of the recession of galaxies, of gravitational waves, or neutrinos, or things like that. But these equations knew about that. And many, many things were predicted before they were discovered, just solving this equation. This equation is here written in a very abbreviated form. Because if you would like to write this equation in full, that would contain about 10,000 terms. And I copied here just a part of this, the same equations, but written in full. And why is this galaxy here? Because it looks like there is a kind of blueprint of the universe here, and this is its implementation. This is a blueprint. We now are accustomed to computer language, so it is a program, and this is its implementation. So, okay. Einstein was used to say that he would like to know only one thing, the mind of God in his act of creation. And Einstein believed that the mind of God is partly deciphered in his equations, in the equations of modern physics. So if we want to look for God, we should not look in the places in which our knowledge breaks down, but where our knowledge is very solid. Then you see in this plan, which science deciphers, you see a big rationality, the mind of God. But this doctrine is not a new one. We are here a little bit on behalf of the St. Augustine College, and this was a doctrine of St. Augustine, in fact. St. Augustine said that eternal objects are just thoughts of God. And in his view, mathematical objects, numbers, for instance, are just eternal objects. They never change. The time has no power over mathematics. 2 + 2 is always 4. Independently of what happens in the world. So this is the idea of God. Einstein says the same thing in a different wording. From that perspective, science deciphers the mind of God. And this is, I think, a main message of my talk tonight. Thank you.